Today I'm going to talk about automating the discovery of quantum algorithms, and in particular I would like to show you how the quantum algorithm for computing state overlap could be discovered using those automated tools. This is a work done with Yi Tsubasi, postdoc at Los Alamos, Andrew Sornborger, and Patrick Coles, both at Los Alamos National Lab. So the plan for the next hour is the following. So after short motivation, I will tell you how we approach automating the discovery of quantum algorithms. I will describe a general framework and also describe methods of evolving quantum algorithms. So how do we start from more or less random algorithm, and how do we get to the solution that accomplish certain tasks that we want the algorithm to accomplish. Okay, so this is the first part of the talk, and I will illustrate all that with an example. So I'll show how this machinery works on a discovery of an algorithm that is supposed to compute an overlap between two quantum states. And as we'll see, we'll discover two algorithms depending on the resources that we allow for the algorithm to use. So if we allow for one ancilla, we'll discover an algorithm that uses that ancilla and performs some measurement on that ancilla. But however, if we do not allow to use any ancillas, but instead we allow to measure all the qubits, not just ancilla, we'll discover much shorter algorithm that we'll call Bell basis algorithm, and it will become clear why we chose that name. Interestingly, this algorithm, its quantum part is a constant depth. So no matter how large those states are, the quantum part of the algorithm has a depth too, and it's fixed no matter how large the states are. However, there's a price that we pay for it, which is there's some classical post-processing required to have this short depth algorithm. Obviously, this classical post-processing is efficient. That is, the time that it takes to compute this classical function is at most polynomial in the number of qubits. But this algorithm here is mostly quantum. So there's very simple measurement that we do, but the price is that the quantum part of that algorithm scales linearly. Its depth scales linearly in the number of qubits. So we see this trade-off, right, between how much we would like to, or we are willing to invest on a classical side, and how much we can reduce the quantum part of the algorithm. So as you know, the current devices are already there, right? We can use them, but they are very noisy. So we would like to compress the quantum part as much as possible and come up with the shortest possible algorithms, even at the price of having more complicated classical processing. So at the end of my talk, I will look at both the algorithms and compare them on IBM Quantum Experience and Rigetti quantum computers. Okay, so first of all, why automating? Well, quantum algorithms are actually pretty hard to find. Okay, so you can look up Quantum Algorithm Zoo website. There's a list of all known quantum algorithms, and this list is only 60 items long. So there are only a field of 60 distinct known algorithms. So this list is not too impressive. So that's because programming those quantum computers are very non-intuitive. Quantum mechanics itself is very non-intuitive, which makes it hard to find an efficient quantum algorithm that would be better than a classical one. So that's one motivation. The other motivation is, even if we know an algorithm to achieve certain tasks, it may not be the most optimal one in terms of depth of the algorithm, or in terms of number of ancilla that are required, or copies of the state, and so on. So it makes sense even to take the existing algorithm and try to compress it in such a way that it's actually applicable on the near-term quantum devices. Also, usually known quantum algorithms, those textbook algorithms cannot be directly executed on the existing hardware, because the hardware that we have now allows only for CNOT, and this is the only two-body gate that we can use, and arbitrary one qubit unitary rotation. So, you know, usually if you open any textbook on quantum algorithms, they are using multi-qubit gates that would have to be decomposed or compiled for a given hardware before this algorithm could be actually performed. And this compilation usually tends to produce algorithms that are longer than they could be in theory. And this is one example that we'll see during my talk. Also, quantum hardware is far from perfect, at least the quantum hardware that we have access at the moment. So if you want to use them, if you want to use those computers, we better make sure that the quantum algorithm that will run is as short as possible. Okay, so it has as few gates as possible, and it should use the simple gates as well. So usually CNOTs are more noisy than one qubit gate, so we should write our algorithms in such a way that is hardware friendly, in a sense, right? So using this approach, we could also tailor our discovery for a specific hardware. So as you will see, I will be evaluating some cost function, and I would like to minimize this cost function. So we can actually evaluate this cost function, not using classical computers, but running on an actual hardware that at the end of the day will be used to run that algorithm. So this has a potential of fixing some of the errors that are present on the device. It could, to some extent, remove some bias that is already present. Okay, so let's think about our approach as a task-oriented programming in the following sense. All we want to specify is a task, so what the algorithm is supposed to do, right? So it could be, for example, add two numbers or compute an entropy, right, of a given state. We would also like to specify resources, so how many qubits do we have, what is the connectivity of those qubits, because this is something that you also should know, those machines that we have access to are not all-to-all connected. The connectivity is very sparse, and we can only use very selected CNOTs in our circuits. So this is something that we specify, and our tool, algorithm should come up with a gate sequence that is an algorithm together with possible classical post-processing that achieves certain tasks that we specify. So let me work on an example, because this is so far pretty abstract. So let me consider an algorithm that actually computes an overlap between two states. So this is one of the algorithms that we found using our automated technique. So our task is to compute modulus of the overlap between two states. So those states are here in those data qubits. Our resources are those five qubits, because we envision running this on a IBM QX4, which consists of five qubits with that given connectivity. So as you can see, I'm not allowed to have a CNOT between qubit 0 and qubit 4, only those selected ones, and only in that directionality that is given by this arrow. So if I want to use anything else, I need to build that gate using this universal set of gates that IBM is giving. Okay, so these are our resources. We have five qubits, we have constrained connectivity, and we have the small gate alphabet, and this is what we are working with. So that's our input, and the output is a quantum part of the algorithm itself, right? So the gate sequence of the algorithm, where those gates are positioned, what type of gates do I use, CNOT, do I use, I don't know, Hadamard or any other rotation, whatever. So this is something that I would like to discover, right? And also, a part of of the discovery is what do I actually measure and what do I do with this measurement? And because this answer that I ask for, this number, this overlap, might be encoded in those probabilities that, you know, at the end of the day I will serve in some non-trivial way. So I also want to optimize over this classical part of the algorithm. So we'll always think about an algorithm as consisting of two parts. So there will be this quantum part of the algorithm, so the actual gauge that will be performed on a device, but also the classical processing. So, you know, whatever function I apply to the measurement to arrive at the number or set of numbers that I'm interested in. Okay, so let me talk more about the approach. So there are several types of the algorithms that we would like to cover, but the general framework is always the same. So we define a task, we think about training set, so how do we train or how do we evolve the algorithm, and then we define a cost function that we would like to minimize. Okay, use it.
In the example you gave us, do you assume that you know that there is an algorithm that does this already? So you, in this
no,
case,
we don't.
This was just an example, but you don't need to assume that.
No. So this is okay. This is very important. I wanted to, you know, mention this further in my talk, but this is maybe a good point. So this is not a compiler, in a sense that we don't need to have an algorithm to start optimizing. We just define a task, like let's compute an overlap, and that's it. Right? This is all the input the computer needs, right? And it should figure out what to do. Okay. So which is very important because those compilers, as you will see, they can tweak things only locally, right? So they try to, I don't know, maybe commute some gates and see are there any cancellations so I can make the algorithm shorter. This approach is holistic, right? It just works with the full algorithm at once and is trying to optimize for example, number of CNOs, or is trying to optimize for the depth of the algorithm or number of ancillas, whatever we want, okay? Okay, so we always have those three things. There's task. Once we have that, we think about training set, and then we write down cost function that will optimize. Okay, so let me give you some examples. So the simplest example we can think of is the so-called gate discovery, right? So I have some operation here, some, you know, huge system size unitary that I want to decompose into gates. Okay, so the training set would be some. So this is a set of pairs of input states and ideal output states. So input states and ideal output state that I would expect for this unitary to transform phi alpha into psi ideal alpha for all alphas. So the cost function simply measures the distance between an ideal solution and whatever the algorithm is giving me at the current iteration. And I sum over all the training data, right? So then when I minimize this cost function, and finally it reaches zero in the ideal setting, I know that the algorithm works for every set in the training data, right? Of course, it doesn't mean that it will work for any states, right? I need to think about this training set carefully, how do I choose those states? It should be sufficiently representative, right, of the entire space. Okay, so this is the simplest example. But consider some complication in which there is classical post-processing. Okay, so the output is not quantum in a sense that, you know, we don't have states at the end of the evolution. We have some number that we read and classically process, right? This example computes trace of a unitary properly normalized. So this unitary sits here, and then we have some algorithm, some measurement, and some classical processing. So the training set will not be a pair of unitaries, and it's perfect, exact trace, properly normalized. And then the cost function, again, measures the difference between an ideal output and the output that we have at the moment. But now this output is a little bit more complicated because now we're not just optimizing over an algorithm, so the structure of the algorithm, all the parameters that sit inside gates, but also we are optimizing over classical post-processing. So we have some freedom in choosing what to do with those measurements, right? So I could imagine that I measure all the qubits and then I have probabilities of finding all the outputs 0001 and so on, and then I'm looking what is the best function that returns the right answer, which is this normalized trace. And in this example, this function is very simple. Actually, you just need to measure the first qubit and then ask what is the probability of finding this in a zeros. Okay, so for the example, just yet one more complication is compute purity of a given density matrix. So here my training set is set of density matrices and its purities, and my cost function again just measures the distance between exact output and whatever my algorithm is giving. Now the complication is that my input, so my encoding, could be more complicated. But here I need to supply two copies of a state. There's no algorithm that would just use one copy and arrive with that solution. You need at least two copies, and our technique should also figure this out. This is one more parameter to optimize over. Okay, so this is the most general framework. So we given some input, this could be states, density matrices. So given X, compute some quantity out of it. So this could be other states. So this is a gate discovery approach, or this could be some number that characterizes that state. And we distinguish data qubits in which we encode our input, but we also allow for some number of Scylla qubits, and then of course we ask for a minimum number of those qubits. Ideally, we would like to find a solution that does not need any un-Scylla qubits. Though there might be some trade-off between the length of the algorithm and the number of qubits. And if you are following recent developments, it's easier for the manufacturers to build chips with more qubits, but the quality is not that good. So it's easy for them to grow, but it's not easy for them to have better qubits in terms of noise, decoherence, and so crosstalk, and all the other errors. So it might be beneficial actually if we insist on the depth of the circuit, but we allow for more un-Scylla qubits. Okay, so where do we have parameters here? So we have parameters that sit inside an algorithm itself. So this discrete parameter of what is the structure of an algorithm, but also we would like to put some continuous parameters inside gates where if a given architecture allows us to do that. And we also have parameters in the classical post-processing. So this is depicted by this vector C here. And also we have this high level parameters, like how many copies of a state do we need, and how many un-Scylla qubits. Yep.
I'm sorry, what is the vector C?
This is one of the parameters that we optimize over. Okay, so this is so C tells you what is the classical function that you would apply to the measurement. Okay, so imagine you are measuring all the qubits, and then there is some classical part which means take this probability, add to another one, subtract something else, and multiply by something. Okay, so this is the classical function that has to be applied at the end of the quantum convolution. Yep.
Is it important that the C function is linear?
The C function what?
It's linear.
No, this is just what we chose because it's pretty hard to optimize overall functions, right? So we had to make some decision. But we could generalize that. But this is not what we actually tried. So this is what we've done. And for example, if you ask for say for Rainy entropy, it probably you better drop the logarithm and not to ask for this function to reproduce something like a logarithm. So there must, there is some human intervention, right, in how you define and what do you ask for. So it's not important, but this is what we've done. Any other question? Yep.
So where are your cost function and the expense parameters? I can see how it looks like your cost function is just optimizing that you get the correct result, but I'm not seeing where like the number of gates and so forth fits in there.
Yeah, so this is something that you set aside of the cost function. So what do you want to concentrate on? Okay, so usually we want to make an algorithm as short as possible. So we could constrain the search such that we have say 5 gates only, right? And all the optimization would be within the space that is generated by 5 gates only.
So 5 gates is the same expense no matter which 5 gates they are.
Say again, how many?
So that's the only thing that's important, the expense is that there's 5 gates.
No, we could define different figures of merit. You know, it's
okay, so the expense doesn't
it's not
directly the cost. It's something you
find. No. So this is something that we have to decide on. Right? Like, do we want to have less signals? Right. So shall we look for a solution that uses less signals because those signals are super noisy as compared to other gates?
Do you do that by just enforcing that there be a certain number of signals?
Yes. So this is what we do when we simulate everything on a classical computer. So when there's no noise. But if we are running the simulation on an actual quantum computer, because this cost function in most cases could be evaluated on a quantum computer. So you know, then we can just forget about all the constraints and let the algorithm evolve freely, and it will find the best solution for a given machine, for a given task, right, without any constraints. Because a priori, we don't know what you know this machine is doing, right? Maybe some qubits are you know way better than the other. Okay, so this is you know something that the optimization will figure out because the cost function will be lower when the algorithm is run on a better qubits. See what I'm saying?
Result of this hardware rather than like a theoretical.
Yeah, so you know there are two approaches basically. So one is let's discover a theoretical algorithm, right? So then we don't care about you know running on an actual device, we don't care about quantum computers, we just simulate on classical computers from the beginning to the end, right? But another approach is to, well, those computers that we'll use are pretty noisy, so maybe we can evaluate the cost function on this computer that we'll use.
But you don't want to evaluate both with a computer, not the whole cost function. Oh, that's okay. Sorry.
We can no. So this is like all the quantum algorithms in reality are hybrid quantum computers. So you know there is a part that you run on a quantum computer, but there is a part that you know you're doing still on a classical. So in this case, we just evaluate the cost function on a quantum computer, and we make all the optimization decisions on a classical computer. Okay, so we are running on gradient descent or whatever you are doing, and then you are just asking the computer, is it a good change, right? It's telling you, no, it's not good, so let's try something else. But you are using quantum computer to evaluate cost. And this cost is, well, scales exponentially when you run on a classical computer, but does not scale exponentially on a quantum.
It looks like the size of the training set grows exponentially with
yes.
the number of data qubits. Is that so?
Yes, it is. So you will see we can solve small cases. We can grow until we get tired. But then, you know, we analyze data and then we guess or we discover patterns in this data set such that we can come up with a general algorithm that in the end we just prove analytically that is correct. But there are examples that actually do not require training data at all. Okay, and this gate discovery is one of them. You can write the cost function such that you don't require training data at all. You can just compute the overlap between two unitaries. One is your target unitary and the other one is this trainable unit. So we don't have cost at all. Another example is when you're looking for a ground state of a given Hamiltonian, then your cost function is the energy of the state that you optimize over, right? So then again, there is no exponential blow up of the training data or Quawa, for example, like the other algorithms that require some training. Any other question? All right, so just to summarize that part. So you see, all it takes now is to optimize the cost function, right? It's as simple as that. Okay, and we optimize over algorithm, this quantum part of the algorithm, which means the gate positions, gate choice, and so on. But we also optimize over classical post-processing and initialization. So how many copies do I need and how do I pack these data? And the techniques will end up using a genetic optimization of structures, but also something that we call continuous variables, and it will become clear in a moment. So let me start with this genetic idea of optimizing over structures. So for this, let me consider the following universal set of gates. So it's Hadamard rotation of pi over 4 around z-axis and C0. This is discrete universal set of gates, which means that any other gate, any other many-body gate, could be decomposed using those. Okay, and then you think about an algorithm, just a sequence, and this allows you for a purely discrete search. Okay, so there are some tools in the optimization community that would allow you to do that. And one is the genetic approach. And the idea is to maintain some population of algorithms. And when you have two good algorithms, which means that they have low cost function, close to zero, then you want to braid them somehow. So, take part of one, take part of the other one, and then combine into one. And then the argument is usually if A1 is close to being exact, it must be doing something correct. At least part of this must be already correct, right? So the idea is, if I randomly select two parts and then I combine, I have some chances, of improving the algorithm.
But Rukesh, is there any intuition beyond what you just said, like this should be a good idea?
No, this is something that people try.
They try it, but
you
chop an evolution.
Sure.
Yeah. With something else.
So just this algorithm, we also tried, we look at whatever people have done in the past, and there are some limits because of, problems? When you are looking for evolution, there are obviously many solutions, many paths, that could lead, from starting point to the end point, right? And those two could be very different. And like you are looking at the beginning, you are doing something else that is incompatible with whatever you want to close with. So to some extent, you can get around this by doing further optimization after you combine those two paths, right? So for example, you can now say that let me just work with the structure. Maybe the parameters that sit inside one body gates need to be optimized. Then you re-optimize and then you check whether this gives you a better solution or not. But in practice, this has limits, and we develop other techniques that go beyond it. But this is something that you can always try. And there are cases that we've seen it works, but there are other routines that are doing a better job than just the simple gluing. Algorithm. Yes?
And how did you find A1 and A2? That's already part of this optimization.
Yeah, so the idea is that you are running some optimization on a given, on all the algorithms. Like suppose you have 100 algorithms, right? And then you are optimizing each one, right?
Okay.
And then, you start mixing, and then you are looking, is there at least one, that would have a good cost function? And if yes, you are taking this into account. And the idea is that, usually those optimizations are very local, right? Because you decide to make some local change in the algorithm, but this allows you to make some global change that at least has a chance of improving your cost function, right? But in the end, there are some other procedures that are doing most of the job, and I'll discuss it. Okay, so let me flesh out some problems with this approach, right? So whenever you have a discrete set of gates, there are certain gates that you can't reproduce exactly. Like imagine just rotation around square root of 2 pi. Right? You can get arbitrarily close with a finite algorithm, but you will never reach it. And when you optimize your algorithm and the cost function is still non-zero, you start wondering whether it's something fundamentally wrong about my structure of the algorithm, or maybe I need to have some different gates that are not present in my gate alphabet. Another one is that when you insist on using few discrete gates, your algorithm may be unnaturally long. Like imagine just preparing state 0, 0, -1, 1 using those four gates. You know, you would need to rotate many times to prepare that state, which could be achieved just by a single gate if you had this in your alphabet. Yeah, but in this approach, you don't. So what we decided to do is we decided to switch to continuous variables, which the price to be paid is that we no longer have a discrete optimization. We have a mixture of discrete and continuous optimization, which from optimization point of view, it's a nightmare. But this is what we've done. So now our universal set of gates is CNOT, so the only two-body gate, and arbitrary unit tree, single-body unit tree. So you can think about this as having three continuous parameters sitting inside every gate. Or, if you prefer, you can think about optimizing over unit trees, and then you don't have to think about how do I parameterize my my gate. So it naturally produces shorter, which means easier to find algorithms, right? Instead of this decomposition here, I'm just looking for one gate, which means that I need to find those three angles that you know that achieve certain task that I want. So this you know looks better. Also, it reflects the current stage of quantum hardware. I mean, this is exactly what the what we are able to do using, say, IBM experience, right? They are giving us CNOTs and arbitrary one-body unit trees. So it makes sense to optimize over one-body unit trees and maybe, you know, don't worry about some discrete set of bits. Yes?
Just a bit trapped in the talk. Are you trying to optimize for a particular result? Or are you trying to create a program that calculates a particular function?
We define a task. Which is specified by a training data, which could be compute you know, certain quantity of all the states.
You want to map input to output.
To output,
and
yes.
And create the product. Okay.
Yes. Okay. Okay. So you know, so another advantage is every time I come up with some algorithm, I can send this algorithm directly on a quantum chip. I don't have to run separate compilation, right? Everything is as it could be on a quantum machine. I'm just using the right gates. Okay, so this is again the approach of the optimization. So we have those two parts of the approach to optimize structure. So to decide, you know, where do I put gates, and you know, in what order, what type of gates, and so on. And then we have this continuous variables part in which we set the structure fix and then we optimize over all one body gates. You know, and this optimization over unit tree is known. So what we do is we pick one gate, we fix all the others, and then we ask what is the best unit tree I put here to minimize the cost function. And the answer for that is, you know, to compute certain environment of this object and compute singular value decomposition. So we are fixing everything but one gate. We answer a question, what is the best gate to put at a given place, what is the best unitary, and then we move to another gate. And then we sweep until we find convergence. So this optimization of a continuous variables is very, very important in the approach. It had to be, you know, run as fast as possible, and we tried a few algorithms, and this is the one that outperformed all the others. You had the question.
In classical calculations, there's the notion of stability, that sometimes you have an algorithm, and you make a small change to the input, the output changes dramatically. And
yes.
By the other algorithms that are stable, a small change to the input leads to a limited change
yes.
to the output.
So
is
we can.
A problem in quantum computing as well?
Yes, sure. So this is why you would like to train in the presence of noise, because then you would discover an algorithm that is more resilient to noise than just random algorithm that was obtained using perfect simulator, right? Without any noise, without any coherence and error. So this is something that naturally fits in this approach. This is something that you are doing on the level of how do I compute cost function, right? Do I evaluate it exactly on an exact quantum simulator, right? Or do I run it in the presence of noise, or even do I can even decide to run it on an actual device. And then, okay, so this is optimization over continuous variables, but we also optimize over structure. So, you know, we are randomly, locally updating the structure, and after every change in the structure, we re-optimize continuous variables, and we are doing this back and forth. But then, so, you know, we started with some simple functions, you know, I change position of a given gate, or, you know, I remove some gates, shuffle around. But this, you know, tend to produce local minima, which we analyze, and it looked terribly silly. Like there are many clustered CNodes next to each other that could be replaced just by one gate. So there are many, you know, local minima that this optimization method would just get trapped. So, but then we wrote more procedure that would try to eliminate those bottlenecks. So we would scan the algorithm and look for some places that could be compressed. Like, you know, if you have several CNodes, maybe you can replace it with one CNode. You know, there might be some other non-trivial operation that you would apply it on a part of the algorithm such that you could remove this silly place, right? That is not easily removable by some random updates, and then this would give you additional freedom that you can, you know, leave this this local minima. So we ended up writing functions that would scan the algorithm and look for places that could be compressed. You know, you could take some 10 gates and try to write that part using smaller number of gates. That would give you additional free parameters, you know, that you could use somewhere else. And this, in the end, after we've done this, then we started getting reasonable results. Okay, so let me move on. I have 1 hour, right? Okay, so let me now apply this approach to compute an overlap between the functions. So our training set is a set of functions phi and psi, and their exact overlap. So those are the states that I put here in the data qubit section of the algorithm. I allow for some oscillas, I allow for some post-processing, and at the end of the day, I want to compute this quantity. So I optimize over algorithm structure, over those classical post-processing, and possibly I could set some number of ancilla qubits and some copies and so on. And my cost function, again, simply, you know, measures the distance between an exact solution and whatever, you know, the algorithm is given at a given iteration. Okay, so this algorithm to compute cost, to compute the overlap between two states is known, right? This is the textbook algorithm. It just uses three gates, right? There are two Hadamards and control swap. Right. Unfortunately, on any computer that we have access to, there is no native control swap gate. You have to compile it. And this is the best known decomposition of control swap into CNodes and one-body gates. So it already uses 16 gates. Okay. This is already after some simple optimization. Like, there are some gates you can remove because they don't affect measurements. Okay. So now, we try to discover an algorithm that will be significantly shorter than this. So this is the standard textbook algorithm to compute an overlap between two states. Okay, so once again, we have this, let's call it human generated, right? So you take a textbook, you take a paper that tells you how to decompose certain gates, and then you just write down a solution and you just run it. So this is the algorithm that we found using our approach. First, we allow for one ancilla, and we decided that we can only measure that ancilla, right? So there are some constraints that we can put on our optimization procedure. And we found an algorithm that takes only 8 gates to arrive at a proper solution. And the way we achieve that, so we think that 8 gates is the smallest. So what we're doing is we are setting the depth of or the number of gates for the algorithm, and we are trying to optimize the cost function as far as we can given training data. We try to optimize this cost function, and then if it's not zero, then we allow for more gates. Okay, so as you can see, we start just from one gate, right, and then we go down the cost function, but we reach zero only at 8 gates. So at 7 gate, the algorithm is not perfect. It's still approximate algorithm, which, you know, could be used as well in some settings, but to achieve a perfect algorithm for theoretical reasons, we need 8 gates. However, when we change the assumption, so now we decided that we may keep the ancilla, but now we allow to measure all the qubits, there's actually an algorithm that takes to just 2 gates, just CNOT and Hadamard. But the price for this is that the classical post-processing is now not that trivial as it was here. So here you just measure sigma z, basically. So you measure probability of finding this qubit in zero and subtract the probability of finding a qubit in one, which is measuring Pauli z matrix. So here the measurement is not that simple, and it also scales in a non-trivial way when we grow our states. But nevertheless, we can show that this post-processing is still linear in the number of qubits, so the entire algorithm is sufficient. Okay, so there's some human intervention needed in the approach, because when you just read the data, the gates look random. So there's not much information, you know, we can read out of those randomly looking matrices. But, you know, when you think about it, then there's, you know, lots of freedom in choosing the solutions, right? So you can come everywhere here and introduce a proper resolution of identity and change those gates without changing the actual algorithm. Okay, so for example, I can come here and introduce introduce resolution of identity that consists of e to I some angle times z, because this gate commutes with the CNOT, and, you know, I could modify those two gates without changing the actual outcome. So in other words, every choice of those angles gives a valid solution. So then, you know, we could fix this freedom and arrive at and discover that there is actually simple expression for all those gates. And at the end of the day, we found that one of the solution is just a simple combination of Hadamards and T gates. Okay, so far we've been looking at the algorithms that just take one qubit states, right? But, you know, how do we scale this? How do we come up with a solution that would work for any size of those states? So our approach is to study a sequence and try of larger and larger systems and try to discover some pattern that, you know, would allow us to guess a solution and then to analytically prove it. So what we've done, we took the next step, which is 2 qubits, and we just, you know, perform the entire optimization once again, now using 5 qubits, and this is the shortest solution that we found, and it using 14 qubits. Okay, so this is second step, right? So, but already having those two solutions allow us to write a general solution. You just, you know, keep staring at this for some time and you try to discover the building block, try to discover a pattern. Yes?
Just to make sure, it's not exhaustive though, right? So there could still be shorter ones, right?
There could be, yeah. So, you know, at 13 gates, we managed to lower down the cost function to, I don't know, 0.01. It's not a proof that there is no sequence that would give us zero, but, you know, this is if you want, this is an upper bound, okay? But it looks like it's the right solution because we can discover how this scales. So when you look at the algorithm, you could see that there is some building block of those few gates that is in some sense repeated in the larger algorithm. So you have this ancilla qubit that is busy, right? There are all the one body gates sit here, and those CNOTs are, you know, reaching further and further. So you can write down the general solution and you can actually analytically prove that this is the right one. Okay, for the belt basis algorithm, it's much easier to recognize the pattern. It's just those two gates, right, that are repeated, and then the non-trivial thing is actually to understand what is the classical processing, but it turns out to be a simple tensor problem of you know this vector when you properly permute the qubits. But an important thing here is that this classical post-processing is still efficient. It's actually linear in the number of qubits. So this algorithm has fixed depth. If you think about if your machine allows you to run all the CNOTs at the same time, right, which is not the case for some machines, but in principle this could be done, right? Because they are not they don't act on the same qubit. So those could be run in principle. Those could be run in parallel. Okay. All right, so we could use this approach also to discover, as I mentioned at the beginning, to discover an algorithm that is tailored for a specific device, you know, given its weird connectivity, you know, different set of gates and whatnot. So all we have to do is just to change or to restrict the gate alphabet, because so far there was, yes?
Just to be clear, the previous examples were all done with simulators. Those were all just run on a classical computer.
Those optimization? Yes, yes. On a noiseless simulator.
Okay.
All right, so to discover an algorithm tailored for a particular device, all we have to do is to restrict the gate alphabet. You know, so far there were no restriction on CNOTs or on one-body gates, it's just whatever the optimization method wanted to use, you know, it was available. But we could restrict that. So for example, so if that's for a fully connected hardware, does that work? If that's for a fully connected hardware, then say for an IBM XQ4, so one of the quantum chips that that we use with this particular connectivity, actually the algorithm is not much longer, right? If you look at the connectivity, they all match this this bow tie geometry at the price of just wanting one extra gate. We can do the same for a Rigetti machine. So Rigetti is a bit weird. They are using control Z apart from control not. Of course, you can rewrite one gate in terms of the other, but actually if you let it evolve from a random algorithm, you will discover a shorter solution than just by taking this one and trying to rewrite using another alphabet. So this is so it's better to start from scratch, so it's, right? Rather than rewriting one alphabet in terms of the other. Okay, so we tried those. So we try all of the algorithms that we came up with, also the textbook one on both architectures that we had access to. So IBM machine, we took one qubit state, and there is an angle alpha that set the fidelity between those two states, and the black curve is the exact result, and it's like 1 minus cosine square for those two states, and we are considering three algorithms. So two are computer-generated, and one is human-generated in a sense that I take this textbook algorithm and decompose into native set of gates. So as you see, this human-generated is not performing good. Well, those two are not as well, but they are way better. They are way closer. The exact solution than the human generated. Okay, we tried this also on a Rigetti machine. They have so on a Rigetti they have their own compiler. So we just you know ask them for any gate and then they can compile it for you. And this is compilation that Rigetti provides, right, which is pretty long and results in not that good result. But then when we tried the shorter algorithms that were tailored for this specific architecture, we got results that were much better. Okay, so let me point out that the textbook algorithm and the algorithm generated by a computer are not equivalent in a sense that it's not that the computer generated one is not simply just smarter compilation, you know, of this control swap gate, right? It's actually doing something else, right? Then swapping those two states in a particular way. So to see that, you can take the textbook algorithm and think about the entire algorithm as a unitary and Schmidt decomposed along this cut that you consider Ancilla as one subsystem and those two states as the other. And the Schmidt rank in this case is two. But then the computer generated one has a Schmidt rank of three, which means that there is no unitary that acts on the subsystem such that those two algorithms are equal. Okay, so it's not that the computer generated one is a simple decomposition of control swap plus some unitary that does not affect the measurement. So it's doing something else. Okay, and you could ask, so what this is? And actually, those two algorithms that that computer found are equivalent. You can take one and arrive at the other one with some processing. So what you do is you take this short algorithm that what you measure here is this Bell state measurement. So you have this 1, 1, 1, -1 processing, and then you can show that you can remove that part and introduce doubly controlled knot with a single measurement and one ancilla. And then now all it takes is just to decompose this this free body gate using known results and then apply some simplifications, and you arrive at this algorithm that was independently found by another optimization technique. So they are doing the same. Okay? And actually, analytically, it's much easier to show that this works for arbitrary large size, and since they're equivalent, see, they all work in a general case. Okay, so let me summarize. So as Gifre pointed out at the beginning, let me stress that this is not a compiler. We don't need some solution to begin with, right? All we need is a task. We construct the training data, we think about cost function, and we optimize, right? So we don't need anything to start with. This is not compiling, okay? This is discovering something that's potentially doing something else than known solution, right? So I described a framework for automated algorithm discovery. We ended up using this universal set, which consisted of a CNOT and arbitrary one-body unitary. We optimize over structure of the algorithm and continuous gates, and also post-processing and number of ancillas. So what we are now working on is we're trying to also optimize this part when we look for patterns in the algorithm for different sizes. So in this case, it was very simple. But when we tried to apply it for more complicated algorithms, it becomes harder and harder. So we are working on a technique that would try to look at the set of algorithms for different sizes and then try to find those building blocks automatically, because this is what we need to write a general solution that would scale with the number of with the size of the states, for example. So we're also working on this hybrid quantum classical optimization, so something that I mentioned at the beginning. So it's better to optimize or to evaluate a cost function directly on a quantum computer, because you can take into account the bias that is already present. You don't have to mimic this bias using some, first analyzing the device, building an error model, and then optimizing on a classical computer. You can actually run the optimization on a quantum computer. This is easy to say, because the way that the IBM works is that when you submit a job, you wait 5 minutes for a single simulation. So you submit a job, you wait 5 minutes in the queue, and you get an answer. And if you have to loop over, then it takes a while. However, Rigetti works in a different way. You book the device for yourself for a few hours, maybe for a day, and then it makes sense. So the quality is different. So it's better to use IBM, but it takes more time. The other application that we are working on involve preparing ground states of a Hamiltonian and writing shorter algorithms that would simulate real-time evolution. Okay, with that, I thank you for your attention, and I take questions.
So you're looking for an optimal sequence of operations.
Yes.
Logically, this is very similar to proteomics. It's very similar to trying to get the sequence of amino acids to get a protein of a particular function. Could it be that similar methods?
Yeah, so this is actually where they started using this genetic optimization, because this is the method of choice in the optimization that you described. But, you know,
so it
works there, but somehow, you know, it needed a boost for quantum algorithms.
I mean, for example, when you see a pattern, right, in proteomics, you see those alpha helices and beta sheets, it could be similar, right?
Some
might functional
be.
Unit.
Yeah. Yeah, but we discovered that, you know, when we lower down cost function, the, you know, the best optimizations are done in different subroutines, not this genetic one, which, you know, from time to time helps, but at the end of the day, you want to spend your time somewhere else. Yep.
Can you give me an idea of the computational cost of the optimization? So, for instance, the number of times you need to run your simulator or run your quantum machine? What kind of numbers are we talking about? How do they scale in the size of the input voices if you're trying to do this for more and more?
You know, so we are searching in a space that grows exponentially quickly, right? But the number of parameter scales slightly linearly in the number of qubits. So we don't see, well, we didn't push it too far because, you know, the cost is exponential of evaluating the cost function. Right, so there is no structure. So the quantum algorithm does not have a structure that would allow for efficient contraction. Right, so we haven't really seen any slowdown, like a significant, when we increase the number of qubits, and then when we look at number of iterations, you know, that were required, but this is like up to, you know, 10 qubits. So, you know, but this is something similar that, you know, you are doing in tensor network when you have hundreds of spins and you optimize over unitaries. It's not much different. But well, the basic difference is that you're no longer, it is not possible to efficiently classically contract the network that is a result of some quantum algorithm, right? You have to go to exponentially large space. When you are doing this on a classical computer, obviously,
you cannot do 100 qubits.
Not using classical simulator, but, you know, you can evaluate cost function on a quantum computer, right? So this is something that right now it's being done with this VQE, right? So they are looking at the, you know, ground state energy of some chemical molecule, right? So they are, so this is hybrid algorithm using many qubits. You're making optimization decisions on a classical machine, but the actual cost evaluation, so the energy evaluation, is done on a quantum computer. So something similar could be done here. And this is something that we are doing, but we need better access to quantum computers, because waiting 5 minutes for one iteration doesn't look good. Any other question? Yep.
You mentioned that you find patterns in there. How important are these patterns? And do you think in the future that the patterns will be more prevalent? You need to put in something to identify patterns and maybe optimize based on the existence of patterns.
Hard to say. Like, maybe it's present in this particular application that the pattern was, you know, so obvious. But usually it's more involved, and this pattern might change. I don't know, every, like, in even number of qubits, this could be different than all. So this could be hard to discover.
So in classical programming, in the language Fortran in the 50s or something, they introduced functions or subroutines.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, are patterns that are kind of random.
Yeah. So
the question is whether you want to introduce functions.
You could. So, for example, you could take this. You could take the algorithm that you found on a small system, right? Take the entire unitary and then allow yourself and then put this as one element of your alphabet, right? So you could use this in future simulations to see, you know, whether it's helpful to discover larger algorithms. And by doing this, you know, you could try to discover this pattern automatically. And this is something that we're trying, actually. So we could enlarge your alphabet by, you know, whatever you already found.
Okay, so is there one more question now? Remember, or let me tell you that Lucas is here today and all of tomorrow, so feel free to approach him. There is a Google calendar that some of you have access to, where you can sign in directly or ask you for time, okay, to talk to me. Other than that, let's thank Ukesh again.
Thank you.